What's going on with China? The country's economic power is undeniable, but whether that power is rising or falling is a source of constant tension in the West. Here with a little history and forecasting is Yashen Wang, author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of the East: How Exams, Autocracy, Stability, and Technology Brought China's Success and Why They Might Lead to Its Decline. Yashen is a professor of global economics and management at the MIT Sloan School, and he joins us now to share five of his key insights.
Hello, my name is Yashen Huang. I'm a professor of global economics and management at MIT. The rise of China is a consequential development in our time, and yet the phenomenon is often poorly understood and interpreted. One reason is that the serious books on China are often highly specialized, and they have a limited appeal beyond the community of scholars. In this book, I tackle some of the big topics about the country, and I have written the book with the intention to reach to a broader audience. Let me share five insights from my book. First, have you ever wondered about the durability of the Chinese communist regime? Well, I have, and I have thought about this question for 10 years. The result is my book, The Rise and Fall of the East: How Exams, Autocracy, Stability, and Technology Brought China's Success and Why They Might Lead to Its Decline. China is one of the five remaining communist countries in the world. On October 1st, 2023, China will celebrate the 74th anniversary of its founding, superseding the lifespan of the first communist country in history, the Soviet Union. That, of course, presupposes that the Chinese Communist Party does not clasp before then, fulfilling a prediction made by a long line of Western observers, most famously by Gordon Chang. His book, The Coming Collapse of China, was published in 2001. It seems more than 20 years on that coming is a relative concept. To put it mildly, the Chinese regime has gone through a lot, but it has survived to tell us about it. It has withheld shocks of catastrophic enormity, such as the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and the 1989 Tiananmen crackdown. It has successfully pushed back against the liberalizing effects of a growing middle class, globalization, private sector, and the rising living standard, defying the expectation that economic development would lead to democratization of the country. Against all odds, the Chinese Communist Party has held on firmly to power. Today, it has 96 million members. If it were a country, it would rank 16th largest in the world. Where does this staying power come from? I trace the staying power of the Chinese regime to an institution established in the 6th century, the civil service exam, the first letter of the East formulation in the title of my book. For 1500 years, this civil service exam system, known in Chinese as Kezhu, drilled the Chinese minds in autocratic values and deference. It also wiped out any competing forces with the state, such as aristocracy, bourgeoisie, independent intelligentsia, church, that is, those forces that in other societies checked and balanced the state. China is a state without a society. Second, why are so many economic success stories East Asian? If you tally up successful economies that took off in recent history, many of them are East Asian. First Japan, which modernized as early as the 19th century, then South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Since 1978, Chinese economic growth has averaged around 10% a year. It turns out that the first letter in the East formulation, the institution that drilled autocratic values into the Chinese people, also contributed to East Asia's stellar economic growth. The Kejie system originated in China, and it spread to the rest of East Asia. Everywhere it went, Kejie incubated and fostered literacy, numeracy, and work ethics. Kejie is all about memorization. To pass the highest level of Kejie, a candidate might need to commit between 300,000 and 400,000 characters to memory. We now know that just having right policies and institutions is not enough. A culture of growth is also needed for economic development. Kejie bequeathed this culture of growth, and then East Asia took off when the right conditions, such as peace and stability, and pro-growth policies materialized. Third, do you know that China was once the most technologically advanced civilization in the world? Asian Chinese achievements in technology are simply staggering. China led Europe in metallurgy, ship construction, navigation techniques, and many other fields, often by several centuries. Chinese also invented gunpowder, paper, water clock, movable printing press, and other consequential technologies way ahead of the West. For example, Chinese invented seismograph 1700 years before the French. But suddenly and mysteriously, China's technological development stalled, stagnated, and eventually collapsed. The fate of Chinese technology is one of the deepest mysteries in historical studies. It is the last letter of the East formulation in my book, T for Technology. It turns out that Kejie again featured in this story. Kejie weaponized Chinese autocracy and prolonged the stability of Chinese imperial system. Autocracy and stability are the middle two letters in my East formulation. Kejie decimated diversity of ideas and vaulted Confucianism at the expense of other great ideologies of Asian China, such as Taoism and Buddhism. This was a boon to the emperors, but a catastrophic bane for human creativity. Creativity thrived in an environment of competition and diversity of ideas, and it atrophied as China transitioned to an extreme autocracy. China missed the boat of industrial revolution, not because Chinese people were not smart and hardworking, but because Europe had something that China sorely lacked: economic competition, ideological rivalries, and political diversity. This is a sobering lesson from China's own history, and I argue in my book that Chinese leaders today will be very wise to learn from it. Fourth, the Chinese system is stable until it is not. What could be the moment of instability in that system? What could unravel the whole thing? What could go horribly wrong? The Chinese Communist Party is strong because it can draw from the wisdom of thousands of years of Chinese statecraft, including Kejie, which the Chinese state has adapted and improved upon. This is true, but except in one area: how to transfer power from one leader to another. The imperial system was highly scripted and rule-based. The throne went to the eldest son of the emperor, no question asked. The clarity of the system prevented squabbles for power and preserved the stability of the power transitions. Communism is a republican form of government. Other than North Korea, it does not practice hereditary succession. Without elections, legitimacy of a leader does not travel easily from one person to another. This is the Achilles heel of a communist regime. On this critical issue, the Chinese Communist Party is completely on its own, and it has to come up with its own solutions without tapping into the knowledge, norms and the wisdom of its imperial predecessors. That will be its moment of vulnerability. The record of the Chinese Communist Party successfully engineering power transition is a blemished one. Deng Xiaoping sacked two of his own successors, so did Mao Zedong. In fact, one of Mao's designated successors attempted to assassinate him. After his death, his wife and her supporters were summarily arrested, and the leader Mao installed was cast aside. By Chinese standard, Xi Jinping's own accession to power was smooth. But that was because the Chinese Communist Party had instituted term limits and mandatory age requirements. Xi Jinping has abolished the term limits and weakened the mandatory age requirements. While these moves have made him very strong, possibly the strongest leader since the days of Mao Zedong, they have also accentuated uncertainties about successions. The catch of successions in an autocracy is that autocratic power and autocratic stability can correlate inversely with each other. The power of an autocrat makes everybody else powerless, including his successor. This is why so many succession arrangements have gone awry in China and in other communist countries. Can they happen again in China? We do not know, but we cannot rule it out. Fifth, will China ever become a democracy? At this time, that prospect looks thin and dimmer by the day. We often think about democracy as coming from the demands of the citizens who rise up in rebellions against oppressive dictators. Actually, a more likely path of democratization comes not from citizens demonstrating in the street, but from elites within the political system. In 20th century, two-thirds of regime changes in authoritarian countries were the result of rebellions by the political insiders. Democracy can be in the interest of the Chinese elites, but that argument has to appeal to the naked self-interest of the Chinese elites rather than to their ideals. In an autocracy, elites command massive power and privileges, and understandably, many believe that the elites want to preserve the status quo. But there's a saying in China, keeping company with a king is like keeping company with a tiger. The history of the Chinese Communist Party is saddled with tales of once powerful and privileged elites being tossed aside as politics shifted. A former president of China was persecuted to death and was buried under a fake name. Another leader, the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, spent 15 years under house arrest. I used Zhuang Ruo's famous thought experiment, known as Veil of Ignorance, to appeal to the Chinese elites. If you do not know the probability distribution of ending up on the Politburo or in a jail cell, would you favor democracy over autocracy? Would you favor a system that protects universal rights, including rights of yours, when you're being knocked out and purged from power? I compare democracy to an insurance policy. When things go well, you don't need it, but when things go badly, you would appreciate having it. When the marauding Red Guards dragged him out in the struggle session, Liu Shaoqi, China's former president and once Mao's designated successor, waved a copy of Chinese constitution and protested that he had rights. I believe at that very moment, he might have come to the reckoning of the value of democracy. I hope that other Chinese elites will get it before it is too late. Thank you. I'm happy to share these five insights with you.
Thank you, Yasheng. That was Yasheng Wang with five big ideas from The Rise and Fall of the East, how exams, autocracy, stability, and technology brought China's success and why they might lead to its decline. You might also like our book Byte 4, A World Trading System for the 21st Century by Robert Steger. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.